From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them.
Countdown to shutdown. Ted Cruz, scourge or genius? Plus, fresh talks with Iran. Progress or are we being played? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, your moderator holding down the political center, coming to you from San Francisco today. Robert Scheer is on the left across town in San Francisco. Rich Lowry on the right from New York City. Welcome all across town, across the country, across the political spectrum. As we go to air on Friday, and we're taping midday, the lurking government shutdown, Rich Lowry, continues to kind of have its machinations, which are going to continue over the weekend. So this is a moving target as we talk Friday at midday. But the Senate had just passed a bill that stripped out the Obamacare defunding, sending it back to the House, where the House, so far as I can tell, doesn't really have a plan or an end game. And it's not quite clear what Boehner and the leadership and the Tea Party folks will do. How do you see it at this hour, Rich?
Well, I think that's basically right. It turned out Ted Cruz was right when he said last week that the Senate didn't have the votes to defund Obamacare, and a week later that has been vindicated, and the whole ball game is the House. And I think you're right that Boehner and the leadership really have no idea how this is going to play out. They know how they'd like to have it play out. They'd like to kind of give up on the fight over the continuing resolution, maybe get some much more minor matters on there, the so-called Vitter Amendment that would put congressmen and their staff into the Obamacare exchanges and maybe a repeal of the medical device tax. I think those are things that Harry Reid would have to swallow, you know, hard up against the deadline for a shutdown. And then they'd like to move on to a bigger fight over the debt ceiling. But it's not clear whether they can do that because, you know, 20 or so House Republicans on the right of the conference have a lot of leverage, and it's not clear they can get them to go along with that strategy or not.
And then what the big picture on this is always amazing to me, because whatever happens now as we go through this weekend and hopefully avoid a shutdown, or we have a brief shutdown and then something passes, and then we go to this other crisis, you know, in two more weeks with the debt limit, this is like no way to run a government. And Bob, I don't know. I think the world's got to say, how dysfunctional are our institutions? And it's hard to not think that this rump group of Republicans are trying to use these forcing devices in ways that are, seem crazy. But Bob, what's your take on where it is?
Well, whoever said democracy was supposed to march like robots, I think a certain look at the British House of Commons. They have stormy debates. And I think there's a lot to debate about in healthcare. But I think Lowry quoted correctly, Rich, in his column, I thought it was very good, in Politico. This is not a serious challenge. It's playing to the base. And that's why most of the Republican leadership has rejected what Ted Cruz did, because it's not really presenting a viable alternative. They're not going to stop what they call Obamacare. And as the president points out, if it turns out to be popular, they won't call it Obamacare. But they're not going to stop it. It passed. It went through the whole legislative process. It survived the Supreme Court challenge. And what they should do now is, if they were honest about it, was tell us what are the parts they find objectionable and then try to fix those parts. But you can't stop the train from leaving the station. That's already happened. You're going to get run over. And so that's why Ted Cruz is now a ridiculed figure. From his strategic point, again, quoting Lowry, it's to appeal to the base. But I wonder about that Republican base. If you look at it statistically, many of those people must be worried about their pre-existing health coverage being endangered when they have illness. They must be worried about what happens to their children at a certain point. They must be worried about people in their own community or themselves not having coverage, not qualifying, not being able to afford. And yet, so their question is, what are their alternatives? What's the better way to do health care? We are going to have a national health care plan that applies to all Americans. We are. I mean, that's a given. And the question is, what is the pro-free market Republican alternative? And they have not come up with one. They really have not.
And as you keep pointing out, Matt,
the Democrats adopted Romney Care. It's basically a conservative plan that you would think moderate Republicans would embrace, and they have failed to do that.
Well, what do you make of that, Rich? I mean, there's several different issues I want to unpack here, but let's stick with the healthcare thing for a second. What do you make of the view? I think Bob and I both hold that this is basically an adoption of a kind of Romney Care approach, and that the Republicans have never offered, that I can see, anything beyond a plan that would cover 3 million of the 40 or 50 million. Uninsured, and to kind of rant and rave. And I mean, I understand kind of the politics of doing everything you can to kill the thing in its cradle, to discredit it, to make the fight something that is not ended. But to then try and use these devices like the basic funding of the government or the debt limit, where, again, people have to realize no other big country has a debt limit. I mean, in every other sane country, when you pass a budget, the debt that accompanies that budget is thereby authorized because the budget has been adopted. Denmark has something that's kind of like this, but we're the only ones who have this insane thing. And then that gets used as a forcing device in this weird way, because it's the only thing that has to happen, and then becomes the vehicle, Rich, right? That for all kinds of stuff that because it's the only source of power in town. What do you make of it?
Yeah, well, it's not anything new. You know, President Obama said the other day it's unprecedented for anyone to ask for a non-fiscal concession as part of a debt ceiling deal. And the Washington Post fact checker, Glenn Kessler, is very good, went back and looked at that and said, no, actually, since the 1970s, both parties have attempted to extract concessions when the debt limit comes up. And one of the early examples was Teddy Kennedy in the 1970s trying to get campaign finance reform as part of a debt ceiling deal. So I just take it as a given, and I agree with Bob. Politics is inherently messy, and you should expect both parties to use whatever leverage they have. And this is one of the main points of leverage Republicans have. So they're going to use it just the way President Obama, at the end of last year, when we were approaching the fiscal cliff, you had a lot of Democrats saying, well, let's maximize our leverage. Let's threaten to go over the fiscal cliff, even though it'll be damaging to the economy, to try to maximize, the pressure and the influence we have, and forge a deal that gets us as close to our policy goals as we want. And that's exactly what the president did. He got a $700 billion tax increase with no spending cuts, even though he talks all the time about how he wants a balanced approach, because his leverage allowed him to do that. So I don't think this is out of bounds at all. And I also I disagree with Bob and you, I think, also, Matt. I think, this law is still in play. I think it's had a legitimacy problem from the beginning. It's basically never been above 50% in the polls ever. It was a big social change passed on pretty much a strictly partisan vote. And it appears to be even less popular than it was when it passed. I mean, it's just amazing to me that the president still has to be out there almost every day making the case for this and hasn't had a very successful time of it. There was a CBS New York Times poll that showed 54% of people disapprove of the president's performance on health care, which is just astonishing for a Democrat when you consider the context that for decades health care has been a core strength of the Democratic Party. So I don't think Ted Cruz is going to succeed in defunding this thing in a fight over a continuing resolution. But if Republicans take the Senate in 14 and manage to win the presidency in 16, they're going to try just as hard as the Democrats did, to pass this thing to repeal it. And I think it's plausible that they could.
A couple of thoughts before tossing it back to Bob also, which is I think the White House, both in the design of the program and in the way they communicated about it, they've done a terrible job. The design part, the biggest problem is the major thing that will, in my view, ensure the popularity of this plan is that it, once it's actually implemented, which is going to be starting, next month over the next year, millions of people who did not have access to affordable health insurance will be able to get access at group rates without the pre-existing conditions and with subsidies if they're lower income to make this happen. And The fact that the subsidies were backloaded and it took so long, you know, a couple of years, and Romney had the same thing. I think it took 2 years when I talked to the folks who set up the Romney Care Exchange. I think it took 2 years for them to set it up there also. But it takes a while to get the mechanisms in place to do this. But then once it's in place, like in Massachusetts, which was Mitt Romney's signature achievement, it becomes very, very popular. And I guess I agree, Bob, with most of the analysts who are view this as Republicans are doing anything they can to stop this from getting off the ground properly, because once people realize that government can play a important role in assuring some kind of economic security when it comes to their health care, they will like that. And that's not something Republicans seem to want, even though Mitt Romney, their standard bearer last time, did precisely that and deserves credit for it. What do you think, Bob?
Well, let me play the role of moderate here. I think both of you are making important points. I agree with you, Matt, that the more as the program is rolled out and people benefit from it, which many people will, and remember, it's not just the people who can't get health care now, it's their extended families, the people who have to step in and help them, because you're not going to let Cousin Harry just die on the streets or something. You know, you're going to try, and then we all dip into our pockets to help, whether it's our grown children or our friends or relatives, get through, because we don't want them to suffer. And so we'll find that yes, the number of people covered will increase, and that will be a great source of relief to others who are close to them, and they'll respect the program. On the other hand, there's a downside. This program, as with Romney Care, did not address cost. In fact, it made a deal with the insurance companies and big medical providers to deliver patients, to force people to go and to sign up at or experience penalties. And without cost control, there are going to be, as the program is rolled out, there are going to people realize, wait a minute, these costs were supposed to go down. And in fact, for many people, they will increase. And what's more, you have no choice. You are required to have such a program. And I found it very disheartening that the key people, many of the key people who worked on Obamacare in the administration, went through that revolving door. The New York Times had an excellent article on it last week. And they went to work for the big pharmaceutical and big insurance companies to talk, what, further about gaming the system. But we do know that those for-profit institutions, as opposed to a single-payer plan in which the government would actually defend the citizens' rights and protect us, they're going to be in bed with the people who are going to best exploit the system. And, in fact, they're going to get filthy rich advising those people on how best to exploit the system. And I consider that shameful.
Well, Sure. And both sides do that. We've got people feeding at the trough on both sides who've been in and out of government. But Rich, just stay with the Obamacare thing for a minute. Do you want to have a plan that offers basic coverage to the uninsured? And if it's not the kind of I understand Obamacare can be tweaked. It could be there could be a less regulatory intensive version of Romney Care. But do you want something that involves spending federal money to subsidize low income people like the Romney Care approach? Or do you think it doesn't matter beyond just wanting to repeal Obamacare?
Yeah, well, a couple things. One, I think it's always a mistake to take what a Republican might do in Massachusetts and project that onto the entire Republican Party and the conservative movement and say, oh, that's the Republican plan, because there are plenty of Republicans and conservatives, particularly the Wall Street Journal, it's just hell on Mitt Romney for passing that plan. So it was never Republican Party orthodoxy by any means.
Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation, an analyst who I respected for doing this back, 15, 20 years ago, was the one who was crafting this as a more market-friendly approach that kept private insurers in the game, that didn't do the single-payer route. And so it certainly had a conservative pedigree. And I guess my question still is, what does Rich Lowry want, if not this, for the 50 million people today?
Stuart was always a little bit of an outlier on this. But anyway, just dropping that, I think we have there are two different views of what insurance should be. And, Obamacare, it's kind of mandated, comprehensive style coverage, whereas insurance should just be protection against catastrophic expenses. So the approach that's been outlined by conservative policy wonks for a long time now is basically finding ways to make it easier for people to buy their own high-deductible catastrophic coverage that's renewable and that they can own themselves and is not dependent on having a job and getting their insurance through their employer. And National Review has just been pounding away on the Republican Party saying, please present something like this so there's an alternative, so it's not just an entirely negative case against Obamacare. And we've been heartened the last week or so, something called the Republican Study Committee in the House, which is a conservative group that has about 175 members, has offered a positive plan that's a step in this direction. So that's the alternative vision. You'd have some people who couldn't get coverage. You would try to take care of them through high-risk pools, which actually are something in Obamacare, but are apparently quite poorly constructed and funded and have been a big fizzle. But if you actually did them properly, you could take care of and subsidize the people who would be uninsurable.
Up ahead, the verdict on Ted Cruz plus an opening with Iran. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on one of KCRW's mobile apps or leave a comment on our Facebook page. And be sure to check out Matt Miller's new podcast at kcrw.com/thisisinteresting or wherever you download podcasts.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller of The Washington Post, Robert Scheer of TruthDig.com, Rich Lowry of National Review and Politico. Just want to finish up on Obamacare before we do a kind of Ted Cruz assessment is, Rich, I would absolutely support if the Republicans would come forward with a universal catastrophic plan, and I mean a universal catastrophic plan with some kind of funding for preventive care or health savings account that were funded for preventive care so that low-income people made sure they had preventive stuff covered. And that would be a starting point as a way that there'd be bipartisan consensus on universal coverage and universal catastrophic. And that idea has been around. Paul O'Neill was trying to get traction on this in the Ford administration, believe it or not. He's the last moderate Republican and couldn't then. It still requires, but you need to do it that way. I think the high-risk pools end up being these stepchildren in the budget. They've always underfunded. People don't care about it. You have to get everybody in some kind of common pool. But the Republicans would still have to put up money to do that, and they never will. And, you know, when the Republicans actually put up a plan like that, and the CBO could say it will cover the 50 million uninsured, that would be a big start. But until then,
standard,
it's like a fraud.
By that standard, Matt, Obamacare is a fraud. I mean, according to the CBO, a decade from now, there are going to be 30 million people who are still uninsured after all this upset and after all this expense.
And Bob and I,
and after
we
all
criticize
these, all these false and all these false premises. I mean, the president is out there suggesting still that everyone's cost for health care is going to go down when that's false. There are going to be some winners where it's going to be cheaper. There can be a lot of losers where it's going to be more expensive. Why can't he admit that? He said throughout the entire debate, you can keep your health care if you want it, which is not true. Lots of people are going to be dumped onto these exchanges. So one of the reasons I think it's still unpopular is there's so many false assurances made during the course of the passage and the subsequent salesmanship for this piece of legislation, now law.
I don't disagree about those two points about the uninsured that'll be left. Yes, Bob, and about the cost. You're right, Bob.
Bob needs to come in and moderate again.
I feel like an outsider in this discussion. I think you both make valid points, but you sort of missed the main picture here because you both oppose single-payer plans. And that's what works in this society. It has worked for seniors. It's worked for the very poor because the government, which is handling those tax dollars, can step in and do the tough bargaining. And it's in the government's interest to do the tough bargaining about costs. And what the Democrats did, and I think it was totally opportunistic, beginning with Hillary Clinton, who really set a very shameful example, is why does she turn to the profit makers, the people who've driven up costs, and said, what kind of plan can we have that you'll embrace? And then Obama followed the same thing. How can we have a plan that will make you richer rather than, cut into your profits? Well, that's not an improvement. And I, what I am afraid of with this plan, I think we have to support it because it's a first step in the right direction. But I share Rich's concerns about cost. There's no mechanism to control it. There wasn't in Massachusetts. There isn't now because there's no one negotiating for the larger public interest. And you keep bringing up all these other modern countries with very few exceptions. They have a variant of a single payer. There is a guarantee, that there is a strong government presence to regulate the payment and the cost increases. And that's the real crisis here. And I can tell you as someone, I'm in a position that I think a number of people are in. I work for a company, the Tribune Company, the Times Mirror Company, that guaranteed us health care up until through retirement. Well, they went into bankruptcy, and suddenly, while a lot of fat cats got paid off, the insurance was sacrificed. That was gone. And then you find yourself buying private plans. And since I still work at an advanced age, I have to pay. I can't use Medicare. And I find that my Blue Cross provider is not a very good negotiator on my behalf. And anytime you have something serious, you run up substantial costs on a regular basis. Every echo exam you have, every serious machine that they tell you should use is going to cost you, $500 out of your own pocket or maybe more. It's routine to get thousands of dollars in bills. Now, I can handle it. Other people who are in a tighter budget can handle it. And so I think to talk about health care reform and not talk about controlling costs is a misnomer.
All fair points, and we're going to have to move on. I urge people, though, I just did in my podcast, This Is Interesting, an interview with Bill Hazeltine, who just wrote a book on Singapore's healthcare system. Singapore spends 4% of GDP on healthcare. We spend 18%. They have better health outcomes, a higher ranked healthcare system, enormous costs and value differences that we could learn from on exactly the points Bob makes. Let's talk for a second, though, just about Rich. Ted Cruz has become this subject of national conversation. Lots of criticism, including rankled egos from his colleagues in the Republican Party. But if you look at what his ambitions are, you have to say nobody knew who he was a year ago, and he's at the center of the national dialogue now.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the filibuster didn't really have any legislative purpose, and it wasn't really a truly filibuster, but it was really a masterly performance in its own way. I can barely put two sentences together if I haven't gotten 8 hours of sleep, and that he could stay up all night and still be on his feet and quite effectively parry an onslaught from Dick Durbin, who was quite well rested and showed up trying to score some points. And the same thing with Harry Reid at the end was quite an impressive performance, and it rallied the conservative grassroots. And if he runs for president, those are the folks he's going to need to support him. And I would analogize it to Ronald Reagan opposing the Panama Canal Treaty, where you had all the respectable people, quote unquote, rolling their eyes, and even conservatives saying it was a mistake. And the treaty went through, but it still bonded Reagan to the grassroots, which helped him in 1980. Same thing with President Obama on the Iraq War. It was a huge benefit to him that he had absolutely pure position on the Iraq War. Did he succeed in defunding it, in 2007? No. But the fact that he had been standing there fighting really helped him in 2008. And I think the same could be true of Cruz if he runs next time around.
Bob, just a few minutes left. We can't do full justice to the opening to Iran. But talk about what you made of the kind of kabuki dance and overtures and where things stand in these emerging conversations with Iran on nuclear weapons.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb again and say that I think there's a chance that we're going through a sea change in terms of how we see the United States in the world and how the world sees us, and I think it's for the good. I think we saw that the intervention in Iraq was not helpful, that Afghanistan has not worked out. That's a sentiment shared by a broad swath of the American public, but also, by Republicans and Democrats who took that lesson and applied it to Syria and you know, gave the president, you know, raised serious questions, as did the British House of Commons. I think in Libya we've seen, you know, we intervened in some kind of half-hearted way, but also there's now a center of al-Qaeda training and what have you. So none of these interventions made the U.S. more secure. They were incredible drain of resources, the loss of lives, Syrian, Iraqi lives, but also American lives. And so I think we're at a time when we're seriously questioning whether the United States has to be the policeman for the world, whether we are a disinterested participant, whether this makes us secure. This doesn't mean that we don't care about the world, doesn't mean we're not involved, doesn't mean we should cut back foreign aid, doesn't mean we shouldn't intervene to prevent genocide, doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned about the spread of nuclear weapons. But, you know, we're not the big cop on the block that has to that should rush in. And I think this is, I just want to say in a positive way, I think the new elected leadership of Iran is very promising, and it would be a very big mistake to turn our back on this offer of serious negotiation over these weapons. As in case of Syria, they now turned over the list of their chemical stock, and so I think it's a great new day.
Just about 1 minute before we rant, Rich, on this point, Charles Krauthammer on Friday had a column that was pretty powerful argument, I thought, that, you know, we're going to be played by this search for the Iranian moderate when this is somebody who is kind of talking nice, but, you know, while they continue to spin the centrifuges that are getting them closer to a nuke.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I think that essential cynicism about this is justified given Rouhani's own past performance. He was the chief negotiator in 2003, 2004, 2005, and that phase, and quite adeptly played the West along while the Iranian nuclear program continued to advance. And you don't have to take my word for it. He has spoken publicly about how this was the game and this was the goal. So, you know, so far, even though there's been a lot of economic pain now that Iran has been subjected to, they haven't backed off their program one bit. So I would be shocked, really, if it's a sincere and genuine outreach rather than an effort to just delay this entire process, maybe get some easing of the sanctions, and certainly to try to forestall a potential Israeli attack.
We've reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center rant, featuring incredibly truncated pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Really just about 15 seconds each. Robert Scheer, it's your soapbox.
Yeah, I just want to say the Krauthammer position, he's been wrong on almost every issue. And if we cared about the spread of and the development of nuclear weapons, we wouldn't have cozied up to Pakistan as the Bush administration did. Pakistan was the source of the nuclear material for North Korea and for Libya. We've been totally cynical and hypocritical. We are the only nation in the world that has ever dropped these bombs, killing hundreds of thousands of people, and we've got to get off that high road that we're on the side of the saints here.
Rich, you've been left with about 8 seconds.
I'm adamant about this. High school chemistry teachers shouldn't deal crystal meth. That's the lesson of the astonishingly brilliant TV series Breaking Bad, which is a wonderful depiction of evil and how just a few lies, a little self-justification can take you down the road to hell.
Canada, Canadian business people. I wrote my column this week. They love their single payer. They are full-throated capitalists who believe in wealth creation and also think single-payer health care is what government should do to provide basic health security. These things aren't inconsistent. They are baffled by the tenor of the U.S. debate. That's all the bafflement we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer and Rich Lowry. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek, with a big thanks to Seal Muller at KQED in San Francisco, plus Darren Peck at Sports Byline in San Francisco. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again for more Left, Right, and Center.
Oh, so if you like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we
know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.